Radio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And another fun week in technology. The iPhone has finally been hacked. And, you know, we've been waiting for that. They, you know, all the fanboys have been saying, Apple fanboys have been saying, you know, Apple's never hacked. Well, now there's actually quite a big hack, the Wire Lurker. And so Apple's responded to that, but that has made some degree of penetration coming from China. I'll talk a bit about Wire Lurker. We're going to feature the website of the week. This website has found 71,000 unsecured webcams.
Wow.
Around the world, and you ought to see what's on some of those webcams. People have no idea what they're broadcasting. You can embed YouTube videos in your blog now. There's a big copyright thing here. You just don't have to have the link. We'll talk a little bit about that. And if you're a blogger, that's really good news. And the police have been cracking down on the dark web. This is the web that people use encryption to hide themselves, in using basically proxy servers to hide all their illegal activities, and the police have been on that. And today we're going to feature the guy who invented the digital camera back in 1975. And of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
Profiles in IT.
Well, right out of the box.
Listen, Mr. Big Voice, would you get back on the mic and quit drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes?
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Okay, that's more like it, Mr. Big Boy. Would you make a note and dock him a little on his pay this week?
So done. It's already done.
All right, very good, because we've got to keep him under control.
Is that even possible?
It was a huge mailbag. Just a minute here. Oh.
That doesn't sound as huge as it did last week.
These electrons are really heavy, you know. We got an email from Mary Wilson. Dear Dr. Schertz, I finally got a response from Ooma. Now, of course, Mary's been getting this whole Ooma deal. She installed Ooma, and she's got Verizon. She can't get Ooma to work right. Ooma is, of course, a voice over IP system. I've been using it for years with Verizon. I love it. I get great results, and I just worked right out of the box, but Mary's not having a problem with that. I told her to go to the web. I gave her some tests she had to do, post the tests. So apparently she did the tests I recommended, sent them to Ooma, and she finally got somebody to respond. She got somebody assigned to her. They call them a customer advocate or something. So she said, I did the test. They gave me a B rating for my line with some jitter. My download speed was 4 megabits per second. My upload speed varied between 4 and 10 megabits per second. Jitter varied between 0 and 4 milliseconds, and packet loss was 0. So jitter is caused when packets, instead of coming at a uniform rate, some are a little bit faster, some a little bit slower. So there's kind of a jitter in the arrival rate. And that jitter, if you're doing voice over IP, can be disruptive. And so she finally got a response from Ooma, and Ooma said quality of service could be an issue. This is how they prioritize packets on the internet. So if you have high priority, in other words, high quality of service, when a packet comes in, they just whip it right through. If you got low quality of service, they don't whip it right through that fast. If anybody else has higher priority, they put them through first. There's a chance that at each node, you could actually have a little bit of delay or some jitter because you're waiting for other higher priority packets to go through the node. And quality of service is a feature of TCP/IP, which is the protocol on the internet, to enable things like video or voice to go through where quality is an issue. So they said, perhaps you need to adjust the quality of service on your router at home. And they said, I think you should try that because you've got jitter in these results. Actually, Mary, unless you've got teenage sons or teenagers that are downloading MP3s all the time, I just don't think you're going to have that much problem at home. I don't know that I agree with this. I did have a problem once when my son was at home, and he would, like, load up just downloading all this stuff, which I'm quite certain was legal, but there was a lot of it
yes.
going on. And he just hogged the bandwidth. And I had to go in there and basically give his computer low priority so I could get my important stuff through.
Your Dr. Schertz important business
stuff.
That's right.
So I could get my important stuff through. I could also remotely go in and just knock him off the network. I could just disallow his MAC address. So he said, whatever you do, Dad, do not turn off my computer. I got important stuff going on.
Click.
So, no, I'd leave his computer on. I'd just disconnect the MAC address from the network so then I could use it. And then once I was finished with doing what I want to, I don't know how I got on this sidebar, but it's what you have to do when you've got shared bandwidth. So if you don't have a shared bandwidth issue, I just can't imagine you've got a quality of service issue on your network, Mary. Now, it could be that you've got a neighbor who's stealing some of your bandwidth. You know, maybe if you didn't secure properly with the password, if you left the default password on, that's very commonly done. People try to, steal some of their neighbor's bandwidth. You know, they did a survey. 30% of the people admit to stealing their neighbor's bandwidth.
Yeah.
Worldwide.
Right,
So it could be that your neighbor's stealing bandwidth, and then that would create a quality of service issue. So you could change the password if it's still a default password. You can go into the router, the Fios router. You can go into the router. You can log into the router. And the Verizon router address is 192.168.1.1, which is the standard router address. And then you'll have a splash screen. You got to put in your username and password. Hopefully they have given you the password to your router. If they haven't, you'll have to reset the router. Or sometimes they give you a default password on the router, and they put it on a sticker on the side of the router. You can look that up. So the username is typically admin, and then there'll be some. Then you can log in there, and there's an advanced tab. Click on the advanced tab, and you'll see a quality of service thing you can click on. And then you can actually locate the device, which is your UMA device, in the list of devices, and you can pick that device, and you can select the quality of service for you. I'm just thinking this is barking up the wrong tree.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's a quality of service issue on your local network. I think the guy at UMA punted. I think the real issue, there was actually a news article last week that the FCC had discovered that one of the ISPs was creating fast lane and slow lane traffic on their network. And they were letting fast lane traffic go through for all of their customers. And then Netflix, they were making it slow lane traffic. How did they do it? They adjusted quality of service. So I think this quality of service issue is upstream.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's being done by Verizon, because Verizon has been fighting these net neutrality rules. And so I'm thinking it's going to be upstream that way. Now, when I went to the UMA, I didn't talk to anybody in California. I went to the UMA threaded discussion site, and I saw people had posted all of their numbers on that threaded discussion on the UMA website. And I gave a link to that threaded discussion 2 weeks ago. People posted it there, and the people at that, the service people who were monitoring that website, were actually going to Verizon and dealing with this quality of service issue, which was upstream, which I think is the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, even though they recommended you go in and you reconfigure your router, if you reconfigure it the wrong way, it's going to be a mess. So I just really don't think that's an issue. You might go back and make certain that nothing else is on the network on your local, your local network. You don't have any computers downloading stuff. You don't have anything else which is using bandwidth. And then make certain that If you've got a good password, you've got something other than the default password on your router so that your neighbor hasn't logged into it. You can actually go on, by the way, you can go in, if you log into your router, you can actually, there's a log in there, and you can see if anybody's, you know, if anybody's using it, that your neighbors are on it, you can easily do that. So that's kind of my advice. I think the guy punted with you. And the fact is, I'm using Verizon, so I think it could be that they might be able to, what they did for the, when they fixed these other guys that had a problem, they had Verizon reroute their traffic to other servers that may not have the quality of service issue. So I think there's a solution to this. We just don't have the right combination of people. So take and post your things to the UMA website. I spent a little bit longer on this because I think this is going to be increasingly a common issue as people dump their phone lines, go to voice over IP, as people dump video entertainment and go to Netflix, and as ISPs start playing games with quality of service to create a fast lane and a slow lane and to violate the net neutrality law. So I think this is going to be an increasingly big issue, and so it's worth spending a little bit of time talking about it. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, today I tried to clean up some files and documents in Finder. She, Margaret, has a Macintosh, so Finder is like the equivalent to Explorer in Windows, or File Explorer, Windows Explorer, where you're exploring around and looking at your files. So I simply wanted to get rid of some of the files. I wanted them gone, so I moved them to the trash can. Well, after a while, I noticed that instead of going into the trash can, they were all landing up on my desktop.
Oh, wow.
So they weren't going in the trash can. Now, I can't drag them. When I try to drag them into the from the desktop to the trash can, I can't get them to go in. I hope you can please help. Thanks, Margaret. Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. I mean, when you drop into the trash can, you sort of highlight the trash can to make certain that it's that they're going to go in there. And I'm certain that you did that. So you make sure you drop them right on top of it. I don't think that would be your issue. But if you're not exactly over the trash can so it's highlighted, they won't go in. I think probably the issue is file permission. If I don't really know what files you were doing, you were dumping, but you see, files could be locked, and you may not have permission to delete them, or if they're locked, you can't do anything with them, and they could be locked because another application has them open. So in order to sort of unlock any files that might be held open by an application, I'd reboot the machine, see whether that helps. It could also be a permission issue. Maybe there are these files, if you've got multiple users on the device, maybe the files have a different kind of permission. You can go to the file, you can right-click on it, can look at the properties, and then I make certain that you own the file, that you got permission to do whatever you want with it, and make certain it's not locked. Those would be the two things that I would suggest checking if you can't get them to go in the trash can after you've rebooted the machine, which would clear any inadvertent locks for applications that didn't close completely. We got an email from Arnie. Arnie's a regular listener. Hi, Dr. Schertz. It looks like Tor is showing up again. Through global cooperation, law enforcement agencies have closed Silk Road 2 and 400 other sites. These sites use Tor, which was created by the U.S. Intelligence Service, to assist people living under repressive regimes. The authorities must have developed new techniques to crack Tor. I wonder why they ever made Tor, why they ever released Tor to the public if it's so hard for enforcement agencies to find out about these sites. And I wonder how they cracked Tor. Arnie and Crownsville. Well, Tor stands for the Onion Router, T-O-R. And it was actually developed, Arnie, by the Naval Research Lab. And what it does, you go through a chain of proxy servers, and each proxy server adds on another layer of encryption. In other words, another layer on the onion.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like peeling an onion back. And if you go through multiple proxy servers, like 8 or 9 or 10 proxy servers with encrypted things, it's very hard for anybody to figure out who originated the original signal, because it's gone through so many relays which have been encrypted. And Tor was actually developed as really an initiative of the State Department. There were people who were bloggers and people that were in these repressive countries that wanted to, you know, blog about what was going on. They wanted to communicate. They wanted to get the blocked sites. And so in order to remain anonymous and in order to allow people to go around the firewall, like the Great Firewall of China, the U.S. Intelligence Service created Tor to help people in these repressive countries. Well, then guys who were doing sneaky stuff on the web, like selling drugs, they said, wait a minute here. If these guys in repressive countries can use Tor and their government can't locate where they're located, hey, why don't I use Tor and sell drugs on the web and do other sorts of illicit activities on the web, and the police can't find me? And so there were a whole lot of websites created using Tor. They call it the dark web. So people on the dark web are doing all sorts of different things. And so this particular piece of software, the Onion Router, was really good. And governments hated it because they couldn't crack the encryption. So obviously, this last week, when they brought down Silk Road 2, Silk Road 1 was this big, you know, drug trafficking site, and they arrested the guy running it. And then there was this programmer. It was like last year, this guy was actually a programmer for a Silicon Valley company out there. I can't remember which. It's one of the Silicon Valley companies out there. And so he said, wow, this looks kind of interesting. So he got interested, and he created Silk Road 2 using, you know, and he started getting in the drug business. They just arrested that guy. He's only been doing it a year. And I mean, he could get a pretty significant sentence. But they also arrested, they also located 400 other sites and shut them down that were on the dark web. So obviously, they may have cracked Tor. But as I was reading about it, and of course, they're not going to talk about how they cracked it or if they cracked it. But many people believe that they really didn't crack Tor, but that these websites were not configured properly. So if you've got a website that's configured properly, it's not going to release its IP address information to the real web. It's going to always go through Tor. But many times what happens is that they'll configure it so, say, the web interface goes through Tor, but if you ping the device, or if you do a, or if it does a request for a domain name, goes out to the domain name servers, sometimes they forget to have the DNS request go out through Tor. And so the servers communicate to the web using non-Tor channels that are traceable. So that is how they've located some of these guys. So they started arresting these guys with these configuration issues. So I believe it was probably, they probably found servers that weren't configured right rather than having cracked Tor. I really don't know that. I'm just kind of speculating.
Okay.
But that was a great great email, Arnie. We got an email from Knock in Houston. Hold it. Oh, yeah, Knock, normally from Ohio.
Ah.
This is from the Ohio crew down in Houston. Dear Tech Talk, I'm attending a convention in Houston and would like to record some comments about a few of the sessions using my iPhone. What are my options? Love the show. Knock, normally from Ohio.
But now from Houston.
But now from Houston. I don't know what kind of session they're going down there, but let me give you some hint. You could record video if you'd want with your iPhone, but that is such a memory hog. You really can't. I mean, that the iPhone video is good for like 2-3 minutes. You're not going to do an hour session with iPhone video. You just eat up all your memory. So that wouldn't be it. It's not practical. Now, many people like to do voice comments using voice memos. There's a program called Voice Memos, and it's a great little app for recording voice memos. I mean, a lot of people like to sing songs with it. Like if they want to do poetry or they'll sing songs mm-hmm. into their iPhone, they'll use the voice memo. And you know, it's fairly nicely compressed, so you could sit there and you could listen to the sessions, and you could make oral notes about the session as you're doing it, or when the session's over, you could sing a song about it. Now, also, you could use Notes. Notes is another application in the iPhone, and this is normally you just write the notes, mm-hmm. you know. But what I like about notes is when you bring up notes and instead of writing it, the little keyboard comes up. Down on the keyboard, there's a microphone. So you click on the microphone and you just speak. And when you're done, it will transcribe what you've spoken into actual words. And I'm telling you, the voice recognition is fantastic. So if I want to take notes, I use the voice recognition portion of notes to write my notes right into the iPhone. Hmm. And then when I'm finished, I just email them to myself. So you got a choice here of a little video. You've got you could do audio. Now the audio, you probably could record a longer session because it takes less bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Or you could use the most efficient thing is using notes with voice recognition. But that was a good email, Knock. I hope you don't get in trouble down there in Houston. I don't know what's going on down there in Houston.
Usually when they're recording things, it creates problems for all of us.
Yeah, usually there's something going on with Ohio. I know there's going to be something going on next week about this whole deal. We got an email from Anita in Glen Allen. Dear Doc and Jim, I have a Western Digital Elements external hard drive. And it's not recognized anywhere. I've tried three computers. Before that, I tried to format. I couldn't format it. I need help. Please help me. It's urgent. I have some very important data on it. Thanks, Anita and Glen Allen. Well, Anita, let's sort of look at this thing. First of all, you connected to three computers through some sort of cable. So it could be a cable connection. So I try different cable. I'm working back through the things. It could be a different cable connection. That would be the first thing I would try to make certain that it's not the adapter or the electronics you're using to plug it into to make it an external hard drive. I would check that first. Now, the second thing that it could be is that it could just be the electronics in the hard drive itself have failed, in which case it's not recognizable. But the good news of that, if it's the electronics in the hard drive, all the data is there. None of the data is damaged at all. Now, the one thing you don't want to do, and it sort of scared me, fortunately you couldn't reformat. If you reformat it, you screw it all up because you can actually reformat it. You can do a quick reformat and then you don't wipe the data, or you can do a complete reformat and you wipe the data. So really reformatting just makes it harder to recover the data. So that's probably the dumbest thing you could do. And fortunately you were unable to do that. Now, if you really need the data, I think you need to just go to a professional and search for a data recovery company in your area. And every town, every major town has a data recovery service. Go to the web and then look for one that is highly rated in your town. Get people that do this for a business. Now, it's going to be expensive. They're going to charge you a couple $100s. It's not really cheap because, you know, they do have a whole protocol that they go through, and they can really recover it even if there is damage to the magnetic platen. They can actually go in there and recover bits and pieces from other portions. Because they go back, they use machine language, and they use assembly language, and they go right and they pull raw bits off of the magnetic material, and then they can reassemble those files. So, I mean, one time I had a disk crash, and I got an assembly language program, and I sat there, and I reassembled the hard drive, and I actually recovered probably a 95% of the files. But I'm telling you, I was doing it manually and putting them together, and I must have spent 8 hours, but I didn't have any automated tools, and I was just doing it because, well, it was there, and I should try to learn how to do it. But I spent a long time doing it. So these guys are really good. Chances are they can get the data for you, and I don't think there will be a problem. So the key is just if it's really that important, I just stop doing anything to your hard drive, take it to a data recovery expert, and just be ready to pay through the nose.
There you go. We talked about that last week.
And, of course, you've forgotten, Anita, the golden rule. Back up your data somewhere.
There you go.
Always back up. Okay, we love your emails. Mm-hmm. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll take your message on the show, or else I'll email you directly.
And, of course, it is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. More on us and more about us online at techtalkonline.com. More about our sponsor at stratford.edu. Stand by. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University Innovative Approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
He's slow.
He's getting there. Yeah. I think he had a rough night last night, from what I can tell.
I'm thinking too many Bloody Marys. Well, today we're going to feature Stephen J. Sasson. You remember Stephen J. Sasson?
We talked about him. We're going back into the Wayback Machine for this.
Yeah, this is the Wayback. We actually featured him in 2008, but I thought that we would feature him again. Stephen J. Sasson is best known as the inventor of the digital camera. He was born July 4th, 1950 in Brooklyn, New York. July 4th, he's an Independence Day boy.
Is indeed.
Sasson received a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering in 1972 and a Master of Science in Electrical Engineering in 1973 from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York. And he was hired by Eastman Kodak immediately after graduation. Now, his invention began in 1975, just a couple of years after he was hired by Kodak, with a broad assignment from his supervisor at Eastman Kodak, Gareth Lloyd. And Gareth Lloyd said, you know, they've just have this, Fairchild has this newfangled device called a charge-coupled device, CCD. Why don't you see what you could do with it? They thought they might use it to build some, you know, some laboratory, you know, diagnostic tools or something. And actually, he was kind of between projects, so it was sort of a, you know, sort of a makeshift project just to keep him busy. And he was only authorized enough money to buy one charge-coupled device. And so he bought one charge-coupled. Now, see, what a charged-coupled device is.
We need a sidebar here, please.
It's a way to move bunches of electrons around the surface of a piece of silicon. So let me give you an example. If you take, say, a contact on silicon and you put an oxide underneath it, and then you basically make a capacitor with the contact, the oxide, and then the silicon, and then you put a voltage on the contact, and suppose you put a positive voltage on the contact, you can attract electrons to underneath that pad, and so that you can hold those electrons underneath the pad. And that's like a capacitor which has charge on it.
I'm going to go build one of these after the show.
So what you do is if you put two of these contacts side by side, you put a whole line of these in a row, and then suppose you get rid of the voltage on one and you increase the voltage on the next one, all of the electrons move to the next pad, and then you ripple the voltage again and they move to the next pad, and you can move them along until you get them off the chip. So you can move through these, and these are charge coupled devices.
It's
like a wave. And so what you can do is they had an array of these things, And they would, and if you shine light on the silicon, you generate electrons. They're trapped under these pads, and then you just clock them out. Hmm. And so you can just clock out the image. So, but these were like brand new then, these charge-coupled devices. And so he ordered one that was about 10,000 elements on it. So it was 10,000 elements. That's 100 by 100. Not, no, see, 100 by 100 would be 10,000. Yeah.
You're good at math. I am not.
No, 100 by 100. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 100 by 100 would be 10,000. So
you keep talking. I'll do some math.
Would
over
you?
Here.
Would you check this 100 out?
100 times 100, right?
Yeah. You, listen, this is Saturday morning, and it was a rough night last night. So that would be 10,000 elements, and so those they're called pixels. It stands for a picture element. Now it was only black and white. And so he took this thing, and when he got it, I listened to, he gave a talk about this thing, and he said, you know, I got this thing, it was in a little plastic box, and there was this piece of paper, you know, that was like folded over and put on top of the chip. So he opened up the box, he got this little piece of paper, and there were nine, and it showed pin numbers, and it showed the voltages that the chip had worked at. Get all the clocks going so you can clock the charges off, and all the clocks have certain voltages. So it said now the design voltages are this, but this particular chip worked at these voltages. So it gave the actual voltages that this chip worked at because they had tested it. And then at the bottom of this little handwritten thing, it said, "Good luck."
Nice.
So we got this thing, and that's all he had. And they gave him no money, no budget.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to work in the back lab. It was this long room. So he and his technician went back there. They cleaned out some junk out in the back, and he was working there. Nobody knew where he was working. He had this chip, but then he didn't have any budget. So he needed. He said, "Well, I think I'll try to make a camera out of this." He says that would be kind of a fun thing to do. Of course, he had no budget to buy a lens. So what he did, he went down to the production line, which was below him, and they were making the Super 8 cameras. They had the Super 8 camera production line. And so there was like a reject case for a Super 8 movie camera, which he stole, brought it upstairs. And so the original one had the optics for the Super 8 movie camera. So he just went around and sort of just like assembled stuff. And he ended up putting this thing together. It was 8 pounds. Ultimately, it was about 8 pounds in size. It weighed 3.6 kilograms, and it was about the size of a toaster. And it only took black and white. Now, he thought it should be able to carry it around, you know, to make it portable, so it used 16 AA batteries.
Good grief. That's not really portable.
Now, this is the deal. He had to sell it to management. Now, of course, back then, everything was...
Here's a car battery that is a camera.
That's right. So, but everything back then, of course, was film. And so he wanted them to sort of understand what it was.
Right.
And so he made and he said, you know, they're used to having film as like a removable cartridge. So he said, okay, I'm going to store this on a cassette tape. So it's like removable, like a piece of film.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wanted to make it conceptually. So, you know, because these are executives. And the higher the level somebody is in the company, the more you've got to simplify it for them to get it in their minds.
Where is this picture being saved? Well, it's in the box.
Because
what does that mean?
This is being saved in a piece of digital film. He called it digital film.
Digital film.
Digital film. Oh, I get it. Digital film. Yeah. So they saved it on a little cassette cartridge. He said, now, he could have saved 30 images, but he said that would just, he could have saved 1,000 images. That would be no problem, just make a bigger cassette tape.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, Kodak was selling two size rolls of film, a 24 exposure roll and a 36 exposure roll. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to make this 30 exposures. Because then the executives say, yeah, I get it. A 30 exposure digital film. Yeah, it makes sense. Because he didn't want to confuse them too much. So then, and it took about 23 seconds for it to actually save the image. Now, he had the other problem. How are you going to display it? Because they didn't have printers.
Sure.
They didn't have printers back then. There were no laser printers. There was no way to print it. So he decided, well, he'd do it on a TV monitor. So he had a TV monitor there. And so then he would save it to the cassette tape. 23 seconds. And then to display it on the TV monitor was another 23 seconds. So So he got this thing all set up. He took the first official digital picture in December of 1975, and so Sasson and his chief technician Jim Schuchler persuaded the lab assistant to pose for them. Now they came out of the back lab and they walked down to this lab assistant, and they said, "Oh," she says, "you're the guys from the back lab. Nobody knows what you're doing." She says, "Yeah, we want to take your picture." So they took her picture, and she was the first picture, and they could see the outline of her hair, but her face was all messed up with static. And so they said, okay, they looked at it, and they said, at least we got an image. And so they went back, and they changed a couple of wires that were reversed, and the image displayed correctly. But she took one look at it. She says, well, you guys are going to have to do more work. So they got this thing all done, and then he said, well, are you going to show it to the executives? And the lab manager said, no, we're not going to show it to the executives of Kodak. This is Kodak. We're not going to show it to the executives of Kodak because, look, Kodak, we're in the research lab. We're supposed to be in research and making better film and better print paper. So now here's a research project that doesn't use film and doesn't print the image on print paper. Now, how am I going to explain the use of the budget for this project?
Right.
They said, I just think it's a bad idea to tell them about it. So, Kodak, 1975.
Right. Film, pictures.
And so then finally he took it, he started taking it around to the lab, and he would take this toaster in there, and he would take somebody's picture. And, of course, it takes 23 seconds to take the picture and then 23 seconds to display it. So he became kind of a showman. What he would do, he would take somebody's picture, and so that they couldn't tell that it was actually this 46-second delay, he would start talking about something else and do this and do that, and then when he was finished talking for 46 seconds...
Oh, there it is.
And then he'd say, well, let's look at the picture now. And they'd look at it, and there it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So he went around, and so people said, now... Okay, so he said, let me get this right. We got this complicated thing, which is the size of a toaster, and it's doing something, which is really, it's not that great of a picture, but it's doing something that you could do with a 1 cent piece of celluloid called film.
Right.
What's the point?
By the way, it doesn't use any of the stuff that we make.
He said, what's the point of this? So then they said, but there were a few people that were within Kodak who were visionary. Everybody in the executive ranks was not a blockhead. There were a few people that were visionary. And they said, well, when do you think this would be actually a useful device? So then he looked at the size of, say, 35 millimeter film and how many effective pixels were on it. And if I'd want to represent something as good as a slide, what would it take? And he says, well, it would take about 2 million picture elements. It would take about 1 million picture elements. And if you want color, it would be about 2 million picture elements. So 2 million pixels. And he said, right now we've got 10,000 pixels. Remember, there was Moore's law that projected that the density of transistors would increase, would double every year and a half or so. And so he then took Moore's law, and he says, well, I don't know if it applies to CCDs, that is, that's the transistor, but let's assume it does. So then he projected that it would take 20 years to get up to be able to make a CCD that had 2 million pixels. So he said, well, it'd be about 15 or 20 years. So then they put it on the back burner, and but there were a few other issues they had to solve. They had to, in order for this to really work, you needed... solid-state digital memory. See, back then he was, how he stored the stuff on this cassette tape. I mean, you're not going to...
You're not going to do that.
You're not going to do that. You need solid-state memory. You also need image compression. And the standards for image compression weren't set. So there was a lot of other ancillary technologies that had to be developed for this to come along. So it kind of sat on the back burner. But then around... And they worked on a number of projects along the way. And, like, for instance, they worked on an image. He worked on an image compression technology because he was working on one piece of it. And they made a device. He didn't realize that they sold this device to CBS. They sold two of them for $25,000.
That were
image compression. And back in, you remember Tiananmen Square?
Yeah, sure.
Well, the broadcasters were there, and they were broadcasting via satellite, these guys blocking the tanks. And then the Chinese didn't like that, so they cut off the satellite. Well, it turned out that CBS had this image compression, which is called the magic box.
No kidding.
That he had made, and he didn't even know they had it. And what they did then, they took the video, they sent it to the magic box, they compressed it, and they sent back a compressed digital stream using a modem over the phone line. And then they reconstructed it at the other end with another magic box.
Wow.
And then the reporter called over a regular landline, and they then superimposed the voice over the image as it was coming in at the other end, and they continued to broadcast Tiananmen Square, and the Chinese could not figure out how they were getting the images out.
And that is why that video was so terrible looking, right?
That's why it was so terrible. That's right, because it was being transmitted over a modem, over a phone line.
Wow.
And so they came to them, and they said, you know, we want to do a news article on this because this is a breakthrough in technology. And Kodak said, no, you can't put our name against it. We don't want to do that. And so they ended up doing a news article, but they couldn't use Kodak's name. So then he started building. So they solved all these problems, and he started building cameras, and he made six. Around the same 1989 period, he made six prototype cameras, and he used a Nikon body. And he made six cameras that were fully integrated with solid-state memory, with compression and everything, in 1989, six models. And they took them around the company, and the company said, what are we going to do with this? It doesn't have film. You don't print anything. I mean, how do we market this kind of thing? And they said we can't really do anything with that. And so it looked like a Nikon digital camera, 1989. So they ended up developing all the intellectual property for digital cameras, and they have around 1,000 patents that were embodied in that camera that they built in 1989. All the digital cameras that hit the market used the Kodak licenses they licensed the Kodak intellectual property, and the first camera, and so they did make some cameras that they sold professionally. Like for $25,000, you could buy a camera from Kodak, like in 1990. Well, that's really not a consumer market.
No.
Then they ended up building Apple's first digital camera.
Wow.
I forget the name of it. And that sold for $1,000. And then, in the mid-90s, it just finally came down cheap enough, and consumer digital cameras just took off.
This really did take 20 years.
It took 20 years, and it turned out that Kodak didn't release their own. In fact, they didn't even want their name associated with the digital camera because they thought it would undermine the film business.
Mm-hmm.
So when he went to the executives, they said, well, you know, we want to sell this digital camera. And they said, if we lose one sale for film, we're not going to do it. And so that was it.
And, you know, the thing of it is, it not only undermined it, it basically ended film.
It ended it, and they could have owned digital cameras.
Absolutely.
And so finally Kodak came out with their first digital camera, branded Kodak, in 2001. But it was too late. They missed the parade. Now, Stephen Sasson now works at Kodak to protect intellectual capital. So he basically handles all these licenses that he's got. In November 17th, 2009, Barack Obama awarded Sasson the National Medal of Technology and Innovation at a ceremony in the East Room of the White House. So there you go. Everything you want to know about Stephen Sasson and how a major company lost the advantage of a disruptive innovation.
Well, and the interesting thing about this is, I mean, we've talked about all these people over the years. He clearly didn't get rich off this. He's still working at Eastman Kodak, right?
Yeah, he's still working at Eastman Kodak. I mean, he's just an engineer who loves to play in his sandbox. And he's quite happy. I saw him give a very long talk about his development and about disruptive technology. He's really quite happy with what he's accomplished in his lifetime. But it certainly was not getting rich.
Yeah.
His stock options on Kodak really...
Right now are probably worth about nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
You are listening to Tech Talk Radio. It is Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. The pop quiz is next here on Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the Classroom of the Airways.
Mm-hmm.
Formerly called a radio show, but actually
we
it's
a classroom. We never called it a radio show.
We've never
you
called
corrected
it.
Me every time I said that.
Now, of course, if it's a classroom, there's going to be an assessment of whether you've been listening.
Test.
And we do this assessment as a pop quiz. If you get the right answer to the pop quiz, you'll get two tickets to Fine Dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, at the Karim Dining Room. And you'll also get an A-plus for this particular class session. Earlier in the week, I was talking about the man who invented the digital camera, Stephen J. Sasson. He made his first digital camera using CCDs. What was the size of that first digital camera?
That's right. So, Doc,
yes.
If people have that answer, they need to get it to us somehow.
Yes,
I would suggest
right. Yes.
Picking up the phone and dialing us and using the following 10 digits in the proper order. If you're calling from East of Brooklyn in New York, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from West of Tiananmen Square, it's 877-936-9333. If you're anywhere else, dial the wildcard line, which is 877-936-9333. But, of course, you may have another idea.
That's right. If you're calling from the Western Territory of China, you can reach us on Skype, and that you'll have an encrypted call, which will be very safe.
Is that east or west of Tiananmen Square?
Yeah, that would be
west of Tiananmen.
I don't know. I think it's east of Tiananmen
okay,
Square. Yeah,
all right.
We'll have to check on that.
Anyway, it's 877-936-9333.
And you can reach us on Skype by simply connecting to Tech Talk Radio 1, and it'll be a call that will be free of charge
or that
and encrypted.
Right.
Let's talk about the website of the week.
Yes.
Insecurecam.com. Insecurecam.com. What these guys did, you can actually surf and look for webcams. You can actually do a Google search. I've talked about how you can do that. So these guys searched the entire web and located all of the webcams. And then if the webcam had no password, they would just sort of catalog it. Then if it was using the default password, because they could tell what the make of the camera was by the names, by the titles on the web pages, they would use the default passwords that came with it. And a lot of people don't even change the default password. And if they could use the default password, they would show it. And they ended up finding 73,011 unsecured camera locations in the world in 256 countries. So you can go to that website, insecurecam.com, and you can look at webcams all over the world. And I'm telling you, there are a lot of businesses that have webcams, you know, for security purposes, but there are webcams inside the house that are in the living room, the bedroom, the baby's room, and people have no idea what they're broadcasting on the web. The reason these guys did that is they wanted to scare people into actually securing their webcam. So if you've got a webcam hooked into the internet, put in a new password. Don't leave it as a default password. And you can certainly do that. I mean, there are 11,000 webcams in the U.S., 6,000 in South Korea, 4,700 in China, 3,300 in Mexico, 3,200 in France, 2,800 in Italy, 2,200 in Netherlands, 1,900 in India. They're all over the world. And as they say on the website, you can see in bedrooms all over the world.
Yikes.
Yeah, so I'm telling you. And the thing that's scary, you can see a lot of baby cribs. And a lot of these webcams have two-way communication, so you can talk. So there have been cases where hackers have hacked into a baby's webcam and say, "Hey, wake up there!" And they talk to the baby right through the webcam.
Amazing.
And so I'm suggesting if you've got any webcams attached to the internet, make certain you change the password and don't have a secure password. It's very, very important.
All right. Okay. We have somebody to talk to on the phone. And we're going to go now to line number one. And say good morning to Dan calling from Middleburg, Virginia. Good morning, Dan. How are you, sir?
Good. Good morning. Great show, guys.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Schertz.
Yeah, we were talking about Steven Sasson. He, of course, the inventor of the digital camera. What was the size of that first digital camera?
Well, it was huge. It was about 8 pounds, and it was the size of a toaster.
That is correct. That's exactly right.
Dan, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling, and we will get your prize out to you in just a moment. Stand by for Andrew Mitchell, who will take care of all of your information.
Thank you.
And this is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. We will be back with more Tech Talk in just a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Apple blocks WireLurker malware. Now, Apple's now blocked the launching of Macintosh apps, that are infected with WireLurker malware, after they revoked the security certificates that prevented them from, so they could not be installed on new devices. Now, WireLurker targets OS X, Operating System X, 64-bit, which is on a Mac, and once the WireLurker malware is on the Mac, it waits for an iOS or device or an iPhone to be connected, an iPhone or an iPad. And as soon as it's infected, it downloads WireLurker onto the iPhone or the iPad, and once it's on the iPhone or the iPad, it scans for confidential information and sends it back, you know, like bank account information, password information, that sort of. It's called WireLurker because it's lurking in the background until you attach your iPhone or iPad to the Mac, and then it springs in and transfers.
Huh.
So this was really the first major security breach on Apple, and WireLurker is capable of infecting non-jailbroken iOS devices connected to the Mac. Over 400 Macintosh apps are affected, and they are all sold by a third-party Chinese app store. They're all coming out of China. Who would have thought?
Right.
And so Apple said, we are aware of the malicious software available from a download site aimed at users in China. And we've blocked and identified apps that prevent them from launching. As always, we recommend that users download and install software from trusted sources. However, even though they blocked those apps, once this exploit has been discovered, many other people could develop apps using the same exploit. So the bigger issue is that WireLurker appears to be in its infancy and most probably just a collection of scripts and property lists and binaries all put together on the desktop to make it easy to detect. But it can evolve once it gets out of its some real programmers get into the thing. And with this vulnerability, it could actually become more and more of a serious problem. So now I would like to congratulate Apple. They finally become relevant enough to the world that they've been honored with their own malware.
Their own hacking.
And they've caught up with Apple, as as always. Now, China just doesn't like the security that Apple has put into their iPhone. I mean, Apple's really built a lot of top security in there. So this is one way. I wouldn't be surprised if this was somehow influenced by the Chinese government wanting, because they don't like Chinese citizens being able to do anything anonymously. So I think this WireLurker was probably a government, a state-sponsored kind of event. In addition to that, the Chinese authorities have launched a malicious attack on Apple iCloud, and they were trying to capture the names and passwords of anybody who logs into the iCloud from anywhere in the world. And it was this was reported in the GreatFire.org report. China has an estimated 100 million iPhone users. All of them could be vulnerable thanks to a man-in-the-middle attack that tricks users into believing they're logging into the secure connection. So you try to go to the iCloud, and then they redirect you to another site. You put in your username and password, and then it sends you back. But in the process, they have your username and password. So this was actually also apparently a state-sponsored effort. They are trying to crack Apple in there so that they're not secure. And so this was this attack started on October 17th, and it continued. And now they think they're recommending that Apple users in China change your password and then keep an eye on what you're doing and be wary of this man-in-the-middle attack. Now, Apple did post that the iCloud security was not breached. It was just due to this man-in-the-middle attack, and so you just have to be careful when you log on. So this is just another case of state-sponsored espionage, and they don't like all the security that's built into the iPhone. Embedding your YouTube videos is legal after all. You know, there was this big thing. Somebody filed a court case where a company had embedded a YouTube video from another company, and they actually got the right to include the video if it's available in public. If embedding it in your site doesn't make it available to additional people, it's not a problem. You can embed it in your site. So bloggers can now just actually embed videos right in the site. I'll tell you, this show just swung by so fast. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and visit the Stratford University website at stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about those programs on Tech Talk Radio.
If you tuned in later, would like to hear this program again in its entirety, it'll replay tomorrow at 2 o'clock here on Federal News Radio. We'll see you next week.
Commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500 AM. And online at federalnewsradio.com, the only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Navy football has the day off, but later tonight we have the Capitals playing the Carolina Hurricanes here on Federal News Radio. Pregame at 7:45. The puck drops at 8 o'clock. It's going to be sunny and chilly today, a high in the mid-50s. Right now it is 42 outside our studios in Northwest at 10 a.m.